Psalm 127. Psalm 127. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be examining the topics of children, parenting, the help of the Lord in that, and the hope that the gospel gives for those things. And if you especially look to this side of the room, because we're very segregated right now, you can see that there is a particular application to this to many parents. I will probably look over here when I speak to them. But when I look to this side of the room, some of you are probably already like, this has nothing to do with me. And for that, I call you liars. It does. We're tempted to tune out things that don't apply to us right now. But some of you are married and want children. Some of you want to be married and want to have children. And so you can even say, okay, I need to listen to this for a cloudy day. Not a cloudy day, for that day. I'm sorry, that was weird. It's not cloudy at all. I gotta edit that out of this. But you gotta save it for the time when it might come. But we also have parents in this room who children are grown and out of the home, and they have received what the Bible calls a crown of glory for their gray hairs of grandchildren. And even there are those of you who this can apply a lot more today than you think. Who here has a parent? Great. Then understanding children and parenting is going to help you a lot in your life. You don't need to raise your hands for this, but I know many in this room have strained relationships with their parents. As we go throughout these topics and see what the Bible has to say, the gospel gives us a lot of hope. Because as much as you all and me are currently failing in parenting, as much as you might have regrets of how you parented your children, as much potential bitterness you might have towards your parents for certain things, the gospel of Jesus Christ gives great hope for reconciliation and restoration with those things. I hope that through this series, because God's word is always profitable for all of us, that we would be helped in our own particular contexts. Finally, some of you might be single and want to be single forever. You have no desire to be married or have children, or the Lord might not grant you children. Everything we have to say about parenting and children and family life in general can be applied to the context of a spiritual family as a part of a spiritual church. Paul speaks of having, though he was not married, spiritual children. He called Timothy his son. So as we think about parenting, children, even the value of children compared to the great value of a new believer, the instruction and discipline of children, how that applies to this church, all these things have benefits for us today. Many of us have spiritual fathers and mothers in our lives that aren't our own, and we have multiples of them. And one day, you too, if you obey the scriptures and want to instruct and engage with others and correct others, you will be counted as a spiritual mother and father to many. So that's kind of the introduction of the series. Now I want to talk to you about Psalm 127. It's my burden in this psalm to show you God's gift of, his goal for, and help with children. If you want one sentence, it's God's gift of, goal for, and help with children. There's a lot of prepositions there. In particular, if you want 3 points to remember, I want you to see the immeasurable value of children. The aim of parenting and our great need of God's gracious help. That's the immeasurable value of children. If a question helps you more, I want to ask you, do you delight or disdain children? I want to talk about the aim of parenting. For many parents, I want to ask you, are you on target? And the gracious help of the Lord, the question for all of us is, do or will you labor in vain? Psalm 127, this is God's word. It's a song of ascents of Solomon. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. Father, would you help me, guide me of the words I've written versus what ought to be said, and open ears to hear. Help us to apply this truth to our lives, whatever context, status, or station we might be in today. Amen. So before you'll see in this psalm, children is mentioned in verse 3. And I want to spend a few minutes giving us the context of the psalm and thinking about it as what it is, a song. This is not a manifesto on parenting or on children, although there is many truths in here I hope to draw out. This, above all things, is a song sung by God's people. If you see that inscription that I read, this is part of the Bible. You have the "Unless the Lord Builds the House," that's a man-made title. But the inscription, "A Song of Ascents of Solomon," is something that we've had in manuscripts for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years. And what is a song of ascents? There are 15 of them in your Bible. Starts with Psalm 120, ends with Psalm 134. And it's actually intentionally ordered story of songs that were sent by pilgrim Jews on their way to Jerusalem to worship at the temple during any of those feasts and pilgrimages they would make a few times a year. In Jerusalem, if you don't know geography or read those parts in the Bible, Jerusalem is built on a hill, right? So whatever direction you come from, whatever gate you might enter into, you're going up to the city of the Lord, then up to the mountain where the temple is built. That's why it's a song of ascents, as in ascending, going up. And these psalms are carefully ordered, not just put together because they're short, maybe they were folksy, easy to remember and to sing while we went up. They tell a story that helps to lead the pilgrim to worship. It starts in Psalm 120. Turn back there to 120. Follow along as I kind of give you the themes of these so you can see them. In 120, it starts with a pilgrim in distress, crying out for the Lord's help. It goes on to 121, acknowledging the Lord is a helper. 123, you see an expressing of a longing for God's presence and peace. Even as they travel, you can look in there, they're traveling to Jerusalem. They're praying for peace for that city. As it continues, 123, there's a crying out for the God of mercy to be merciful to them who is enthroned in heaven to have pity on them on earth. Why? Because the road is hard, Psalm 124. Then 125, you have remembrance and thanksgiving for past deliverances. And then that transforms into an affirmation of trust that God is a protector and a champion for his people. That turns into the next psalm, an eager anticipation and praise for restoration and the promise of future restoration. And then we get to the psalm we're at today, the middle of the story, number 8 of 15, the reality and the great need of God's blessing. For unless the Lord labors with us, all of our labors are in vain. Then the story goes on and eventually ends at Psalm 134 with a very short psalm, but they're there. Look at it. It says, "Come bless the Lord with me." Why? Because they're standing at the temple. They've arrived and they are gathered with the rest of the pilgrims in God's presence to praise his name. And yes, that's the story of Jerusalem pilgrims, but it's also your story. You started out with God crying out in distress because you were a sinner in great need. He showed you mercy. And right now, we're in the middle of many of our stories. We need the great help of the Lord, or everything we do is in vain. And that's the main point of this psalm. We see the idea in the idea of vanity. Look at verse 1 with me. Unless the Lord builds a house, those who build it labor in vain. And I don't know if you've ever built a house. I have not. Many of you have also not. But you can imagine you have to pick the right spot. And then what comes first when you're building a house? First location, leveling it, then building the foundation. Then after that, you have to construct everything else. So say you have the best builder out there who does all these things well. Unless the Lord wills it, that's what the psalm is saying, unless the Lord helps them, their labors are in vain. And that might be, that's just spiritual mumbo jumbo. I do my stuff and gravity works. Well, one, the Lord upholds gravity. The Lord has all the laws of physics on the builder's side. The Lord has gifted that man or woman with every ability that they might have to build that. But at the end of the day, he could thwart it in a second. Anyone remember the Tower of Babel? Anyone know what Tower of Babel is? Raise your hands so I know how much I have to explain. So these men, way back in the day, they said, we're going to build a tower. We're going to go up all the way to the Lord. We're going to make a name for ourselves. And they set about with all the things they had to do, making everyone agree, getting the plans, finding the location, starting to build. And the Lord thwarted their plans. The Lord did not build it. And Babel does not stand. Babel was never completed because he cursed them with languages that they might be confounded. That's why we have that word Babel. You're babbling because you make no sense. And they were thwarted. Clearly, if the Lord does not help the builders, their labors will be in vain. It's the same with the next illustration, the watchman. The watchman can be the best watchman, like night vision goggles, all the stimulants and caffeine so that they are going to be awake, and they might even have all the cameras and sensors around to make sure no one is going to come up on us sneakily. But unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. You want an illustration of that? I'll give to you the city of Jericho. They had high walls, did they not? If you've seen VeggieTales, they had many peas with slushies protecting said city. And what did the Lord do to the city? He caused their walls to come tumbling down. Their watchmen were watching in vain because the Lord did not watch over the city. The Lord gave the city over into the hands of his people according to his word. Everything needs the Lord to will to help it, or it's in vain. If you go into verse 2, it's the same with you at your work, even if you're a hustler. If you wake up, the verse is saying, if you rise up early, meaning I'm up before the sun is up, even like when the sun is up for a long time, and I work until the sun is down, I work until I drop. It still says you eat the bread of anxious toil. And though you might be doing good work, you might be busting your butt. You might be actually earning that bread. Who gave you the energy to do that? It says, the Lord, for he gives to his beloved sleep. As much effort as we ever can expel, whether it's building, watching, or any of our labors, we're always dependent upon the will and the help of the Lord. This isn't telling you, okay, give up on work, just pray for things to fall out of the sky. No, that's not what the psalm is doing. Like, there is good work to be had. The normal pattern of life is people work and the Lord blesses that work. If you read the Proverbs, that's going to be really evident throughout it. But the principle is here is your work, no matter how hard, without the Lord's blessing, will be vanity. If he decides to oppose or not to will, it will not come to pass. This is the doctrine of providence, of God's sovereignty, that he rules all things, that he decrees and orders and has all things come to pass. Nothing happens. Nothing is earned or received that doesn't come from his hand of providence. And this truth permeates all of your life. God is the God of all providence. If you were here for Esther, we talked about this a lot. And the good news is God does so often will and decree and order things that bless us, that come to pass by the work of our hands. Buildings aren't built because people are praying for them to magically come down from heaven. They're built by laborers. Things are not fixed without someone putting in effort. So it's by his decree that good happens. And sometimes that good happens without man's work, just by God's goodness. We call this common grace. You ever felt the rays of the sun? You ever eat something good because rain fell and made it grow and then someone processed it and put it to Kroger? Yes, that is by God's goodness. Matthew 5 says that the sun shines and the rain falls on both the righteous and the unrighteous. God doesn't allow even the wicked man's work to be in vain all the time. He is good and he is gracious. He's even good and gracious to establish the work of many nations and rulers, many who are wicked in many ways. But does murder run rampant in our streets? No, we have a government that opposes that. We have systems of law enforcement that exist to restrain that. That is by the will and help of the Lord. He does not allow labors to go in vain. That is good. That is kind. God is a constant help, not just to his people, but to all people, because he is gracious. And we must really grow to see God's help, his goodness, and his graciousness in the little things in our life. Brad was just saying his mercies are new each day, and I would challenge you, you don't understand how new and present his mercies are each day, because you don't comprehend his hand, his goodness, and his grace to allow so many things to come to pass. Think about all the labors of other people's hands that went into your life today that the Lord blessed and sustained. Did you wake up in a house? Yes, someone built that. Did you have running water? Wow, someone's maintaining that, someone built that, someone designed that. The Lord blesses the work of hands. That is good. He deserves glory for even those minute things because he is a good and gracious God. And this is the theme of the entire psalm. And this is why if we're desperate for his help for everything, that without his help, without his blessing, even his common grace blessing, nothing will be done without vanity, how much more do we need his help in the good work and task of parenting? We'll come back to that and apply it more directly in a minute. But now we're finally at verse 3. Up to this point, you could be thinking one of two things. Finally, this sermon is about children, and we've been talking about buildings and watchmen and plumbers and God's common grace. Well, hold on a second. We're about to get there. And then two, you might be going, why in the world is this song going from builders to talking about children? That seems like, I know songs are cool, but most songs are cohesive, and this seems not cohesive. Well, I have an answer for you I'd like to submit to you. In the same way a house is built of some form of timber, brick, or stone used to construct it, a house or a family is built up by children. You don't have a dynasty without an heir. You don't have a clan without many children coming and being given to many people over time. A tribe would never exist unless children continued. But it's more than just this connection. You see that idea? How there's a house. That's like an old English word, like the House of Tudor. That was like some dynasty in England, I believe. In the Hebrew, this is an even more apparent connection because there's a lot of word play here. The same word for builder in Hebrew is, or builders, plural, is the same spelling as sons, plural. So that word children you see in your verse is a plural for sons. You know, commonly in languages, the plural masculine can encompass all genders. But you have sons and builders. There's this connection there. They have, if you know Hebrew language, their vowels are dots, so they have slightly different dots. I think the pronounces are like a ba-neem versus bo-neem. But this is really similar. You know the word resume, the thing you put in with the job application? You know the word resume? They're spelled the same, but one's got that French little dash thing. Yes, this is what that is. So you're like, oh, nice play on words here. And that's a connection of these two ideas, both thematically and grammatically. Unless the Lord builds the house, we labor in vain. And behold, children, the builders, are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb, a reward. Builders of structures and those helpful to build a family labor in vain without God's help. This is the theme that undergirds this entire psalm. It is the main point of it, that we are desperate for the help of the Lord, but also that the Lord so often does give us help. And in making this point, by using children, we get to see a lot of very clear truths presented to us in the psalm. And I want to unpack a lot of those with you here today. And the first thing I want for us to consider together, starting with verse 3, is that children are of immeasurable worth. Children are of immeasurable worth. So my translation I've been reading says that children are a heritage. Some of your other translations will say children are a gift. Both those words are correct. They're both getting at this grand idea. On one sense, heritage is getting at the idea of an inheritance, even of a hereditary inheritance, a biological inheritance, someone who will carry on your name, who will carry on the family line and the legacy, something that will outlast you. That's a good gift. And then you have this word gift, and that's getting an idea of receiving something. You receive a gift from someone else. It's not really a gift if you bought it for yourself. It's just something you bought. And the Lord must grant a child, right? It's a language of possessing, though that might sound a little odd. A parent possesses a child. They have authority over it. They have a responsibility over it. But most importantly, do you give people trash? You shouldn't. You should give people things of value. An inheritance or a gift, whichever one you choose in your translation, both are judged by their value, are they not? You can have a rich inheritance because the grandmother, the family member who left it to you was quite wealthy. Or you can have a miserly inheritance because you're really just inheriting problems or things that require work. That leads to the question, how do you measure the value of a child? I think there are two things that the world often does. The first is by what that child can produce. You might look back at, I guess, our society a few hundred years ago, and you think, okay, if we're going to work the land, we need more children for more laborers. So how much can I get out of this child? Is that their value? If they will, can you have some form of ROI equation that will help you know if this child will give you a good return on your investment? Is that how you determine a child's worth? The answer is no. I would like for you to say that. Is that how you measure a child's worth, by what they produce?
No.
Great. Yeah. Okay, calm down. Or this theme of satisfaction. Is the value of a child based upon the amount of satisfaction or the satiating of some desire that they might give to you?
No, that's awful.
Okay, but calm down here. But do they not, though? Is not having children a biological craving? Does not the gift of a child satisfy us? Yes, it does. And that's not wrong. That is not wrong. It is good and right to dream of having children. They are a good gift, we're reading. And when you're waiting on the result of the pregnancy test, when you're trying, there's a nervous anticipation. And when it shows up negative, there's a real grief and sorrow. Like, we shouldn't just say, because children do produce things. And children do satisfy. We long for them. Is the Bible not full of stories of barren women who are mourning and who ask the Lord to open the womb? And he does, and then they sing songs of great delight? It is. So while a child can satisfy, a child's worth cannot be measured in that satisfaction. Though children are very satisfying. Even if you don't have them, do you think they're really cute? Do they make you smile? Sometimes. When they're cute, do they make you smile? Children are satisfying. And as they age, they do contribute to a family. They do produce. They do help. But But a child's value cannot be measured by those things. And the wrong value of children has led cultures to dump disabled children in the cold and murder them. A right disvalue of children has led our generation and culture to rejoice in killing what they call a clump of cells for a mere inconvenience of their lives. It doesn't bring them satisfaction. It doesn't bring them happiness. So they get rid of it. Valuing a child like that leads to that type of perversions. Rather, a child's value must be determined by how they were made and who made them. Pause. When I say that, I'm not talking about a child's pedigree. We had a conversation at family dinner the other week about being highbrow and lowbrow and this idea that some people have a higher pedigree in learning. Well, I want to tell you, this is not what it's talking about. A child is not worth more because they belong to a social structure or to a race or to a certain hair color or eye color. All these things are wicked things the world creates that leads to murder and hatred and strife. That's not how value is determined. Because when we say, okay, we know how children are made, we're going to skip that part, but parents can labor at that all they wish, but their labors are in vain unless what happens? The Lord builds that house. It is the Lord who is the Lord of the womb. It is the Lord who speaks and grants life. And therefore, it is the Lord who both makes. The Lord is both the how and the who of what makes children. And therefore, it is the Lord that determines their worth. Children are made just like you in the image of God. Okay, that's great. That's great. What does that mean? What does that mean to be made in the image of God? It means many things, so I can't unpack that fully forever and give an exhaustive thing, but it's more than just being created, because many things have been created, right? If being made in the image of God is just to be made by God, then everything would be of immeasurable worth because God made it. Well, that's not what it means. So all things are made, and though we should be good stewards of God's creation, the image of God is a very narrow thing only given to man. If you look or listen to me read Genesis 1, 26 and 27, God says, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image, and the image of God he created him. Male and female, he created them. A baby is going to have their mother's eyes, their father's nose, or chin, or hair, but what makes them of immeasurable worth is bearing the image of God. That image is on display in those verses. They have a level of, actually, they have dominion and stewardship over the entire earth. If the Lord is the ruler of all, we are the ruler of these things, and in that we bear the image of God. It's also evident in our reason, in our emotion, in our language. Animals grunt, animals make sounds, and we'll ascribe to them language, but only we have a unique language. Only we can create things for the purpose of beauty. We see beauty in other things. We love whale songs. They sound beautiful. But only we create things for the purpose of beauty. We, among all creation, have the capacity to know God. Ecclesiastes 2, I forget the verse, but says that we have eternity designed and built within us because we are looking for the fact that we have a soul. But above all of this, I want to submit to you that what is the most priority thing when it comes to the image of God is our capacity to love. You might say, that dog loves me, and that might be, I'm not going to fight with you too much on that. There is some level of affection. We'll fight later, I guess. But only you can love a creator. And only you Only you can love the Creator. You have unique capacity and ability to love Him because you have uniquely been designed for a relationship with Him. What are the two greatest commands in Scriptures? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like this, that you love your neighbor as yourself. That command cannot be fulfilled by anything else in creation. Only you, because only you have been made in the image of God. And there are so many verses in the Bible that describe to God worth. We sang songs about saying, all creatures of our God and King lift up their voices and want to sing. We talk about how all creation is groaning until he comes again. We describe to him all these attributes of power and might and glory. Why? Because he alone is worthy. He alone is of infinite worth. But because you've been made in his image, you and all children bear the same immeasurable worth. Because children are created in the image of God, they are of immeasurable worth. Mankind is the pinnacle of all creation, uniquely made to relate to God and to reflect his glory. Only children and only you as a human being can reflect the glory of God, which makes you more valuable than everything else. Creation might declare it, but only you can reflect it. Only you can image God. And we image him best is when we love him and love others well. But there's a problem. Its name is sin that mars that image. And just as laboring to do anything in vain, laboring to clean up our image, to make it shine fully to reflect God's glory, we labor in vain without the help of the Lord. But the gospel is this, that God so loved the world that he gave his son, so that his son might live the perfect life, die an atoning death, and raise again, so that you might be made new. Not cleaned off like you're a dull mirror, but made new to be able to reflect and grow in that. The gospel offers us hope to restore that image of God. That's the hope of all our children as well. They are of immeasurable worth, but they are unable to fulfill what they've been designed to do. They need the gospel as much as we do. And if children are of immeasurable worth, we should delight in them. Yet sadly, it is easy to disdain them. This disdain comes in many forms. At its worst, it is the culture of abortion. It's that Holocaust that says, I disdain you because I have other values in my life. Therefore, I will kill you. I will dispose of you. But it comes in other forms. I don't see anyone in this room who's going to argue against that. But still, we can fall in the trap of disdaining our own children or the children that surround us. Children can be disdained because they have become a time suck. You take up all my time. Because they're a money pit. You're just so expensive. And they are. But if they're of immeasurable value, every dollar and dime spent is worth it. Or children can be considered the ball and chain keeping you from your dreams and therefore your happiness. It is easy to disdain children. Parents, this might come and go in your life when you're like, I wish my life was different. That's disdaining your children. That's disvaluing your children. And when you look at others, those without children, you go like, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that's not me. That's disdaining those little ones. That's degrading the image of God. Children can be disdained, but they are of immeasurable worth and ought to be delighted in. That's why, you know, a Christmas carol? Scrooge has it all, right? He's rich, but he's not happy or full of joy. Yet, his little secretary, whose name I forgot right now, Mr. Cratchit. Mr. Cratchit has a full family, right? Even a sickly child named Tiny Tim. But are they happy and full of joy? Yes, they are. Because they know where their riches come from. That we have riches of immeasurable worth in these children. We have joy here, even if we have very little money. God bless us, everyone, Tiny Tim's famous cry, reflects this psalm that children are a heritage from the Lord and the fruit of the womb, a reward. So children ought to be received with delight. You, without children, because most of you are over here, Jesus didn't have children, yet he said, let the children come to me. He delighted in them. He delighted to, in the same way we'll talk about parents instructing children, he delighted to give them instruction and care. All this is applicable to all of us. But moving on, the aim of parenting, verse 4. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Charles Spurgeon has a quote that I paraphrased a moment ago, I think, but he wrote, children are a token of good if men know how to receive them, so receiving them as a reward, but also how to educate them. That sentence ends with this truth, one that's reflected in verse 4. The gift comes with a task. Children are a gift, but parenting is hard work. It requires effort. That's what this verse is saying. In verse 4, children are likened to arrows. And I want to submit to you this. The aim of parenting is to produce useful arrows that, when shot, fly true and hit their mark. So if arrows are like children, arrows don't make themselves. They don't grow on trees. Their shafts do, though. Their shafts grow on trees and they're cut out. They need to be made into arrows. Arrows have to be both made and maintained. And the best illustration I can think of this is an arrow shaft needs to be straight to shoot and fly true, correct? How many things do you know that grow perfectly straight for 32 inches? Not much. And even if you think, oh, it's a pretty straight stick, it's going to have a crook or a bend in it. Or even if it's bamboo and you're like, bamboo's pretty dang straight, you know? It's got these little rough little, I don't know what they're called, but the ridges on there. And to make an arrow, those have to be smoothed out. And even whatever little curve is there, they apply heat and pressure to slowly bend it to become straight. Children need to be instructed. They need to receive discipline. And that, they need to be made straight because they are born sinful, born without much knowledge either, and need to be straightened so they would be useful. Useful in society, but also useful to God. And so the task of parents is to produce useful children who are likened to arrows through the means of instruction and discipline. That is that heat and that pressure that helps to make arrow shafts straight. And we must labor at that. Instruction means work. Discipline means repetition. And if all this is a labor, we labor in vain without the help of the Lord. So that's baked into all this. Children require attentiveness. The bumps and the ridges need to be smoothed. That involves knowing your children. If you have to examine a shaft to see, you have to also examine your children, to know them, to spend time with them, so that you might know where the bumps and the ridges and the crookedness might be. It requires great care. You put too much heat on a stick, it's going to catch on fire. You put too much pressure on a stick, and it's going to snap. And then arrows are often oiled, because if wood is too brittle, it will shatter. And a useful arrow is more useful when it's used more than once. But you put too much oil on there, and my, they're going to start warping because they're damp. In everything we do, we must be careful to do the right amount of discipline, to have words that's fitting the occasion. Because we have lots of instruction for our children, do we not? But is all of it useful right then and there, or to that fullness? No. I can explain in great detail to my 4-year-old something that I might be able to explain more to my 7-year-old. But if I do it to my 4-year-old, I'm just applying the wrong type of pressure to the wrong place. And guess what? Arrows need to be maintained over time. Those who use wood arrows today in a market full of non-wood arrows have to look at them and address them over time because they will warp. And instruction and discipline, I'm going to look at the parents who have raised children. Does it happen over and over again? Yeah, it does. And you have grown children? Are you done instructing them?
Never.
Never. This is a repetition. This arrow sits in your quiver forever until the Lord calls you or them home. You always have a vested interest, whether they want to listen to you or not, of helping and wanting them to be shaped, if you are a believer, into a useful arrow for the Lord. That is the desire of every godly parent. And with the Lord's help, I want to talk more over the next few weeks about instruction and discipline and dive down more into what the God calls us to do for that. But for now, my burden is just to ask you, are you working towards these ends? Is your aim to create someone who wants to worship God and comes to know God, or someone that makes your life easy and will get out of your house in the quickest amount of time? Those are two drastically different aims. Do not let those values of production and satisfaction become the aim of your parenting. Yes, they might be able to free you up from your house one day, but if your only goal in instruction is to make them more useful, you're never going to value them rightly or instruct them appropriately. If it's only about how they can further your own personal goals or dreams, or to make you feel better because they fit the world's metrics of success by their going to college, becoming a doctor, being a star athlete. If those are your goals, your children are going to end up as crooked arrows. They're not going to fly true. They're going to end up being destroyed because you've instructed them and aimed them like an arrow at a different direction when the Lord would have them aimed wherever He would will for His delight and glory. But despite your instruction and discipline, you cannot make your children straight alone, can you? They have wills. Some of them are quite strong, and they are lost and blind in their sin. You're going to mess up. Those with parents and not children, your parents have messed up. But the Lord, has the Lord not worked in your life despite that? Has not the Lord brought you to Himself if you are a believer in spite of either your parents' unbelief or in spite of your parents' weaknesses? The Lord will work. And even the weakest labors, parents, is never in vain. And that means it's never too late to start. You can go like, I've messed this up already. It's never too late to start the task of parenting, to labor, because the Lord is the one who works. Here's the thing that I want to close with. We want useful arrows because they give us great delight, but God also deeply desires useful arrows. If you look at verse 5, it says, "Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with children. He will not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate." In a worldly sense, to those who are parents, what do we desire? Loyal, affectionate, and obedient children. Both to us, but unto the Lord, and therefore through us. We desire those children. In the context of the psalm, that means if there's a fight, there's family there who is loyal and affectionate and wants to fight with you. And in the city gates, that's what the law things happen. When there's a civil dispute, they are there to back you up. They want those people there in all times. Brief word on quiver here. The more arrows in a quiver doesn't make you better or more righteous. There are movements out there that will tell you your quiver must be very full, but they neglect the fact that quivers come in all shapes and sizes. Your two children or your one child might be a full quiver to someone else's baker's dozen, and that's okay. But I want to tell you something else. God's quiver holds millions, and as many children that the Lord might help us to make useful, He makes useful for Himself to be shot into this world. And our desires, when held rightly, our aim of parenting is the same in both of them. Parents, do you not want your children to be merciful and full of compassion towards the weak and the oppressed? The answer should be yes. Do you not want them to grow to be protectors of the weak? The ones who, like Job, crush and pull out the fangs of the wicked, who do right, who love others, and who work well. Well, the Lord also wants those, but not just for your benefit, but for His own, that wherever He might launch them, they will be like a burning arrow that declares His glory and shines it wherever He might launch them. Let's labor together as a body, knowing that, hey, if you don't have children here, instructions to instruct and discipline, come the next 2 weeks and learn how that can apply to you and how you can help us raise our children and how the Lord might use you and us to together use our labors and bless them, that these children might be saved.